You are listening to the Accents podcast on WUKY. My name is Katerina Stoykova. I am your host, and this episode has been brought to you by Accents Publishing, an independent press for brilliant voices. My guest today is poet, fiction writer, and activist Silas House. Hi, Silas. Welcome to Accents again.
Thanks for having me.
You are well known to our audience as a fiction writer. You're also a celebrated poet. You served as the Kentucky Poet Laureate for 2023-2024, but now, fall of 2025, is when your first poetry book is coming out. Congratulations.
Thank you. Finally, yeah.
Does it feel different?
Yeah, it feels different in that it's a whole different world, the world of poetry. And it's so much about the language and the craft. Not that fiction isn't, but I think your fellow poets talk more about that with each other. And of course, it brings in a whole different audience to your events. So I'm anxious to meet those people that love poetry.
Let me say right away that I loved the book for many reasons. And one of them is that it gave me a very solid sense of connection.
Yeah, I think the book is longing for connection. A lot of the poems revolve around the theme of feeling like an outsider, feeling lost, feeling like I've lost my country, meaning not only my nation, but also Appalachia. And so that's definitely a thread that goes throughout the book, the desire for community, the loss of community, things like that.
And the book reads like a memoir in poems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially part one. It's told chronologically. And so the first poems are, you know, about my childhood. Some of them are even about things that happened before I was born, but were like family stories that I heard a lot growing up. I wanted to have that big chunk of memoir. It's the most revealing I've ever been in my writing.
I was going to ask if it felt vulnerable.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I've always resisted memoir, and I've resisted using it too much in poetry, and so a lot of these poems that have that element were written a while back, but just hadn't been published before because I did feel so vulnerable. But, you know, now I'm 54, and I don't care anymore as much.
There is something that I have loved about your fiction, but it is even more pronounced here in your poetry. Not a single fake note. All truth, all compassion, all acceptance.
Well, I think that's the thing about poetry, you know? Poetry forces you to distill it down. Poetry forces you to be laser focused. And that's why I love writing poetry, because I really think it's the highest form of writing, because it is so economical. It is all about the perfect word, the perfect line, you know, trying to arrive at those at least. And so, you know, some of these poems I worked on for as long as I would work on a chapter in a novel, or many chapters in a novel. So just because they're short doesn't mean that there's less craft involved. In fact, I think there's more craft involved.
Yeah. I have favorite poems that I want to request reading, but I want to ask about the process of arranging the poems into the book, and also, how did you know when you were done?
How did I know I was done with the collection?
Yeah, or at least, how did you know that it's time to turn it over to the publisher?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that I went back and forth on how to arrange the poems in the book, and eventually I settled on that the first part should be pretty memoir-based, and I wanted the last part to be very of the moment. The last part is very much about...
Very political.
Yes, yeah. It's about living in this moment of vitriol and division and the fear that so many people are going through. And then the middle part sort of connects those two. The middle part is a lot about love. There are a lot of love stories in the middle part, romantic love, platonic love, those things. And so, I don't know, you just arrange and rearrange, and then you finally, it's like working a puzzle or laying out a quilt. You finally see how it goes together well. Now, there's more vulnerability in it for me because it begins with memoir. Because, you know, I'm telling family stories. I'm telling sort of older stories. So I'm asking for the reader's patience to get more contemporary. But I trust that most poetry readers have that.
I think that the readers will connect with the political part faster and easier and more deeply after they have gotten to know the characters.
Yes.
I'm going to request a poem or two. Sure. Right now. I would like to hear Sis, 1956.
It's strange that you requested that one because just in the last few days I've gotten lots of feedback about that when it's this one speaking to people. Sis, 1956. Her son's little hand in hers as they stroll the midway with the barkers hollering at the Leslie County Fair. Every man they pass winks at her or whistles or blows a kiss. One of them says, mm-mm, as if he is just bitten into her. On the Ferris wheel, the metal car sways in the hot August night. The town below them, the mountains beyond, an endless sea. The moon is so alone. She can feel the blues moving in. When the ride is over, the operator unlatches their car and lets his eyes run down the length of her. He is sucking on a dirty toothpick. His lips are red and small. He offers his hand, but she ignores it, so he says, bitch, under his breath. Two men on a rickety stage singing, you're running wild. How long can this go on? She and her son walk through the pastel lights being cast by the merry-go-round. She is buying candied apples when the man presses himself against her, his breath hot on her neck. Want some of that, honey? His whiskied mouth is a smudge at her ear. She plucks the pearl-handled knife from her purse as if picking a berry, flicks it open with her thumb, pivots to nudge the small, clean blade against the pulsing vein in his neck. The man looks down at her in amazement until she relents, turns, and sashays away. She will not give him or anyone the pleasure of her glancing back.
I love that high bun.
Yeah, I think it's the only high bun in the book, and I have been resistant to write prose poems because I'm primarily a prose writer.
Right.
And so, you know, I want my poetry to stand apart from the prose. And so, of course, a haibun is basically a prose poem with a haiku at the end. But this one just seemed to work really well to use prose that way and to put a poetic spin on it and to turn it into a haibun.
I think it worked beautifully, and while you were reading, I was wondering what are people connecting to in this particular poem, and I think that people nowadays love seeing a woman not be a victim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is what, you know, this scene is set in the 1950s, and this character is based on my aunt, who was never a victim. She was born in 1935. She died in 2015, and she was always just this fierce force of nature. And this is a story she told me I was a child, and she would tell me stories like this about pulling a knife on a guy at a carnival because he basically assaults her. And so I just always was in awe of her ferocity.
Right. And let's talk more about writing in form. I saw a lot of poems in form. I really want you to read the poem Happy Hour, which is a villanelle.
I love that poem. I really love writing in form because I think it makes me a better poet to write in form. It hems me in a way that challenges me. And anytime that I'm challenged as a writer, I think the result is better. It's making me think so much more about word count and rhythm. And absolutely, you have to find the perfect word when you're writing in form. Because it must never feel as if you're just counting words or, you know, putting a rhyme where a rhyme has to go because of the form or anything like that. It has to feel organic, or a form poem doesn't work. So that's why I love them so much. So this poem is called Happy Hour. Happy Hour. Sometimes it takes years to find ones who fit like a soft jacket. If they're safe enough in their own skin, they let you be yourself. I never had friends like those I have now. Always before, I had to watch myself. Sometimes it takes years to find ones who fit. Enough is as good as a feast, they say. So keep a small circle of folks living in their own skin. They let you be yourself. By firelight, beneath rain, washed in wood smoke, along the mist-laden curves of highways, sometimes it takes years to find ones who fit. So let's shout cheers and sláinte all we can, whiskied and weeded, more often dead straight, in their own skin they let you be yourself. I will carry you if needed, and when you want me to, I will hush and be still. Sometimes it takes years to find ones who fit in their own skin. They let you be yourself.
Oh, that's so gorgeous.
I wanted to write about male friendship and how important it is and how a lot of men don't have that. I think a lot of men are a bit afraid to have male friendship. And
why do you think that is?
Well, I think especially to express love with a male friend. I think they're just afraid of being, you know, thought of as being too feminine or something like that. It's close friendships are thought of as more feminine in a way.
Well, if friendship is feminine, we should all be so lucky.
Exactly. Yeah. And I also wanted to write about close friends and who are older. I think we attach friendship so much to like high school and college, and we don't talk a lot about friendship when we're older, when it, I think, in a way, is more important than ever. And especially as a gay person, I've had to create a family to some degree. I mean, I lost family when I came out. And so when that happens to you, you have to find your family. And you're fiercely protective of your friends, of your friendships, and you just hold them very dear. They're your chosen family. And so I just wanted to write about, you know, these four guys that three guys and me, the three guys who are my closest friends. And we often have a happy hour that turns into happy hours and just, you know, put a thread through of little inside things that are just for us. And I think that comes through in the poem that these are things that are important to us, but still it transcends that. And the reader gets that because that's part of friendship. And somehow the pantomime just clarifies that and makes that repetition of, you know, having a happy hour over and over and how it never gets old. I think the pantomime delivers on that.
There is a poem that I would like for you to read now. It is a very sad poem.
There are a lot of sad poems.
Yeah.
It's a book of sadness and joy.
It is a book of sadness and joy, and it's a book about belonging and trying to belong. It's a book about truth and the difficulty of keeping secrets.
Yes.
There is so much complexity mm-hmm. here, which I love. Little Fire is the one that I think is appropriate to read right now.
Little Fire. I was always so afraid of being left behind. I was sure the rapture would take you all in the twinkling of an eye. and strand me, because I questioned too much. Sometimes I doubted. Often I pined for the lost boys who sat petulant, aflame on the back pew. One day, the wrath was too much, so I escaped. I wandered for years, an Israelite in the wilderness. Not one of you offered shelter. I stood on your creaking porches with a suitcase at my feet, staring at the closed doors. I heard the clocks striking 7 inside. You watched from the curtain's edge, holding your breath. I had nothing but little creeks and trees to comfort me, dogs, books, music, mountains. I found a family when blood left me in the cold night, but somehow I kept myself warm. All my life, you've told me I'm no good. You've said I am not worthy of God's love, but there was always this little fire burning in me, and no one ever could put it out.
What contrast between the two poems, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yes. This one to me is a lot about being a gay person of faith. And often I think it's amazing that I have been able to retain my faith when I think about how the church as an entity punished me and damaged me for that. It's organized religion is so incredibly hard on LGBTQ people. Yes, more than half of us still retain our faith, according to recent statistics.
Absolutely. I think that this is a spiritual book.
Yeah.
Most of these poems are spiritual poems without being overtly so, even though there are some others that are overtly so. I mean, I see the faith and I see connection to God in a way that the speaker connects with other people, even with dogs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the natural world has always been sort of my balm and my comfort, especially as a child who was raised, you know, in a very fundamentalist sect, hearing constant judgment and wrath. To go into the woods was where I, you know, experienced a creator, or I think going into the natural world is the only reason that my faith was able to survive all of that religious trauma. And, you know, it took me a long time to be able to separate God from church, because the church I grew up in, they were one and the same. And so I think nature allowed me to make that leap.
There is a lot of belonging, but there is also the theme of us versus them.
Yeah.
In the book, would you read at the opening of Coal Miner's Daughter?
This is one of my most widely read poems. It sort of went viral when Loretta Lynn died. It's one of the oldest poems in the book, and is really a defining poem for the childhood section. At the opening of Coal Miner's Daughter, Corbin, Kentucky, March 27th, 1980. A line snaked down the sidewalk all the way to the grocery store. People stomped their feet to stay warm and plumes of white puffed out of their mouths. When snow started falling, a little murmur of joy escaped the crowd. My aunt, Sis, was not fazed by the cold. She drew hard on her Winston and eyed me, leaning down. Blue eyeshadow, chipped fingernail polish, hands worn by waitressing and too much loving and factory work. Are you froze to death, baby? Yes, I was. I didn't care if it was Loretta Lynn. Why did we have to wait so long anyway? Sis plucked the cigarette from her lips and looked me right in the eye. Because, she said, she's one of us. Before that, I had never known there was an us, but ever since, the world has been divided in two.
I mean, I understand the school of thought that says, well, there is no good and bad, or whatever happens, it's not only good or only bad. But having the world divided in two, it's very hard to not have to decide which side you fall into.
Yeah. I think when I was a child, I was very aware that the world had divided us in two. The world saw working class, rural, Appalachian people as the other. They had assumptions about us because of where we were from. And in this poem, I'm able to use, you know, an internationally known icon, Loretta Lynn, to think about the way that having a representative like that allows you to have pride when the whole world is telling you to be ashamed of where you're from. But I think, you know, the thing that all through college, grad school, early on, especially in my writing career, but even still in my writing career, I feel very judged for where I'm from, for my accent, appropriate for the show, I suppose, for talking about working class issues so much. The New York publishing world still is resistant to some of that. And the literary world is a very moneyed world. And a lot of people are surprised by that. But I think most writers who are well known and very well known in American literature come from money. And so often I go into rooms like that and I feel like an outsider. I wasn't raised to know how to use all the silverware. And everybody else in the room was, and things like that. I was raised in a trailer by a creek, you know, whereas most of the other writers in the room were raised in, I don't know, the Upper West Side or whatever. I mean, I'm stereotyping to some degree, but I think on the whole, the literature that Americans are fed is largely by people who were raised with money. And so I've always felt like an outsider for that reason in the world of literature.
Now I think that it would be wonderful to follow with the poem. I don't know if I can remember the title, but it's about there is not much that is expected by girls from Appalachia.
Yeah, Double Creek Girl. Double Creek Girl. They don't expect much out of girls raised on Double Creek. Up where the pines hang low over the road like a tunnel, and the sun doesn't rise until the rest of the world has had its coffee and forgotten the magic of morning already. Up where evening mist breathes over the clean graveyard and gardens with their straight rows. They don't think girls from a place like Double Creek will amount to anything at all, especially when you were little, and they had pictures of girls like you in all the magazines. Life and Look and Time. Once, a man from National Geographic came and took pictures up there. Girls in dresses their mothers made and stringy hair, hollow-eyed, hungry-eyed, sad-eyed. But you defied them, Double Creek Girl. You showed them. Every time you opened a book and drank it up like spring water. Each time you read a poem and closed your eyes at the end, savoring it like a good hunk of cornbread. Seeing it like an azure sky, tasting the words like the wet in a bloom of honeysuckle. You showed them when you listened to every word the teacher said and walked that commencement line and took your degree from the hand of the professor who was secretly one of them. He never thought you could do it, but you did. See here, our Appalachia, our bone and blood. Listen, our Double Creek Girl. You are what happens when we know that God lives in between the pages of books and at the tips of pencils and on the sharp edges of notebook paper. That's something they'll never know.
There is this composite character of they in the book. Talk about.
Well, they is the them that's opposite to the us. You know, it's the people who are judging you based on stereotypes and
being different.
Right. They're assuming something about you because of your accent. They're assuming something about you because of the kind of school you went to. You know, that sort of thing.
You know, it happens to me often. When people hear my accent, they ask me, where I'm from.
Yeah.
Like, where are you from? And I tell them I'm from Bulgaria. I mean, many of them don't know what that is.
Right.
And then the question that I hate even more is something like, do you ever go back home?
Hmm. Well, the insinuation is that this is not home.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
That's right.
Yes.
Do you ever get asked, where are you from?
Oh, yeah, all the time. And sometimes people think I'm from Texas. I was once in Ireland, and somebody asked me if I was from Australia. You know, I was in Iceland, and someone asked me if I was from the West, like the American West, like Montana. So people hear all different kinds of things. A lot of it is based on what they've heard in the movies. And, of course, the movies, you know, are usually accents are pretty terrible. Most people think that I'm from the Deep South and that I sound much more deeply Southern than I do Appalachian. I think one thing that bothers me is when people will say, you have a real Southern accent, or they'll say, you have a real Appalachian accent or a real country accent. And I don't like that because my response is, well, there are many different kinds of Southern accents. There are many different kinds of Appalachian and rural accents. So don't hang your hat just on one.
What I think is that you have a lovely accent.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. The main thing I don't like is when somebody demands that I repeat something back, demands that I pronounce a word. Like sometimes people say something like, say dog again, you know, or things like that. And I'm just like, I'm not here to perform. Not in that way, anyway.
So which one is the newest poem in the collection? They're pretty topical,
yeah.
Some of them. Which one was the one you wrote most recently?
The most recent poem is actually the first poem in the book. And I wrote it because there's this theme that runs all throughout the book of time sickness, a longing for a place and a time that you can never get back. Mm-hmm. And it's not that you're romanticizing that time necessarily. You're recognizing the things that were difficult about it, but you want to go back there because people who are now dead are there, or that way of life is gone forever. And so all throughout the book, there's this sense of a longing for those people in that place. And so I wanted a poem that would tie all of that together and sort of, I thought it was a culminating poem. I thought it would be like the epilogue of the book. And so when I turned it in, it was the epilogue. But my poetry editor at Blair, her name is Sandra Beasley. She's a wonderful poet. She suggested that it actually be the prologue. It's an after poem, mm-hmm. in that it's after a poem by A.E. Housman in his collection, The Shropshire Lad, which is one of my favorite books of poetry. You want me to read it?
Please.
Lost Place. I hear a song that kills, yet is a hinge from my country so far, so close. What is that green remembered ridge? What trees? What pastures are those? I float above crowded porches and tables, all these ghosts just beyond my reach. I would love them more if I was able to go back in time and believe. I recall the wild places, fecund, rich. I wade into the creek, diaphanous myself. Am I haint or witch? Listen to me. Once here was happiness. Now this is the land of the beguiled. I see it before me, so plain, the little paths I trod as a child and will never mark again.
Very appropriate to open the book, yes?
Yeah. This poem to me is a lot about losing a place, not physically or time-wise, but its values have changed. And the people that I know to be so kind and good-hearted and loving, the majority of them are voting for a regime that is not. And I have a deep heartache about that. And so that's what the poem's about, and I think a lot of the book is about that.
Well, you made a movie about that, too.
Hillbilly. Yes, in 2018, I was an executive producer on one of the subjects of a documentary called Hillbilly. That examines a lot of that. It also examines some of the stereotypes we've been talking about.
I have a two-part question. One is, what should we do when times are dark? And then, what do we need in order to survive?
Well, I wrote a poem that addresses that, so maybe I can read it and then we'll talk about it more. This is called The New Regime, and it has an epigraph from Yeats, "A darkness drops again, but now I know." To survive, sometimes you dance on the porch or you cry on the kitchen floor. I've howled in grief before, and if it helped, I'm still not sure. Put on the kettle, brew the tea, stir the stew, and we'll visit some more. To survive, watch closely, listen with a cupped hand, and when you come, holler loud to let me know. If you moan, it feels better. If you're quiet, they'll kill you, and no one will even know. Be still. Always fight back. Keep moving. To survive, don't pick the flowers, but slip your feet in the creek. Don't turn on the light, or they'll see us inside. Shine bright enough, and you'll blind their snipers. If they tell you you're crazy, show them that you are like a fox. To survive, be cunning but kind. Be shrewd but never mean. Be a knife that is sharpened each time they cut you, but keep the meat of your heart tender. Be aware. Watch closely. Do not truck in empire. We need no kingdom, for the power and glory are ours forever. So I think for me it's about finding that balance of fighting back but never succumbing to hatred yourself. It's about being fierce but never mean. It's about being vigilant.
And when they go low, we go high.
Right. Yes. I do believe in that. Yeah. I also think there's a thin line sometimes between grace and acquiescing. Yeah. You know, that we have to find that balance between giving grace to people but also not being a doormat for them.
How did or did it your term as a poet laureate shape your poetry writing?
It made me more serious about writing poems and putting them out into the world. For most of my life, I wrote poems and then I just didn't show them to people much. I mean, I've had poems published over the last 25 years, but it's not something I really pursued. And as poet laureate, I found myself often being asked to write poems. And that's probably the hardest thing about being poet laureate.
I agree, yeah.
Yeah, is having to write an occasion poem is one of, I think it's the hardest form of poetry because poetry should be organic. And when you're writing an occasion poem, you really have to strive to find that organic part of that process. For instance, I was asked to write a poem for the second inauguration of Governor Beshear, and I was very honored to be asked that, and I read it at the inauguration. But at the same time, it's pretty daunting to try to write a poem that is accessible to as many people as possible and that speaks as resonant for as many people as possible, but it also is not precious, you know? And so I just thought a lot about what we'd been through together as a Commonwealth, and of course, you know, the natural disasters, floods, tornadoes, and COVID. And so then I just told my personal story about that, and then it worked out. It did become organic, but there was a lot more thought behind that than I usually put behind a poem. Usually, most of my energy on a poem is spent on not the idea, but on the craft. That poem did lead to this book, though, because once that poem was out in the world, I started getting emails and phone calls from publishers asking me about a book. And I didn't have a collection. You know, I had lots of poems that I had published over the years, but I think a collection needs to be cohesive. It doesn't just need to be a bunch of poems you throw at the wall. And so once that happened, I started writing a lot more poems. I would say at least 80% of the poems in this book are new. You know, they're in the last 2 years. And then other ones are older ones that fit the theme of the book.
Is it emotional for you to read those poems?
Yes, some of the poems in here I can't read. I mean, there's some poems about animals in the book that are really hard for me to read.
Oh, I was going to ask you to read, the one about the owner carrying his dog.
Yeah, sometimes I get really emotional towards the end of this poem. And the only reason I hate that is because I worry that somebody in the audience will think, he's so moved by his own words. That's not what it is. It's that I'm moved by what I'm thinking about. And I'm thinking about dogs and how much I love them and the loss of an animal and things like that. For you who have loved old dogs, old Andy is a big dog. Black as a night sky in the most lonesome winter months. He is fat even though he doesn't eat much these days. His man is one of the best folks I know. They were hiking deep in the high mountains when good Andy's back legs stopped their work. The old dog folded himself down on the path, his eyes lighting on his man's to apologize. My friend carried him nearly a mile, this great sprawl of blessed animal, who must have lain in his arms both thankful and ashamed. They collapsed together at the end of the steep trail, holding on to each other, exhausted. I'm thankful for you who take care of old dogs. I'm glad you have one another when you need a friend the most, that you've had times of stillness, watching the world, that you know the grace of silence together. I thank the infinite eternity and the God of my understanding for people like you who carry them when they need you. 3 times now I've held an old dog in my arms as they left me. 3 times I felt their heartbeats fade away on my palm, witnessing a shooting star become more darkness, the end. All is lost and gone. I've grieved for each of them just as much as I have for people I've loved. I've carried the sweet sorrow with me, a heft I wish I did not have to bear, but one that I will always cherish now. The burden of my empty arms is the greatest weight. Yeah, that's a hard one to write. It's a hard one to read aloud, but it's also, I feel like, a necessary poem that I really needed to write. I have been in deep grief after losing 3 dogs in quick succession a few years ago. And this happened in conjunction with losing my beloved aunt, who was a third parent to me. And so all that grief is all tangled up together.
There is this poet, Sarah Freely, she says, grief is cumulative.
Mm-hmm. Since, that one's so devastating, I followed it in the book with a more comedic, but equally emotional one. So I thought that was a good balance to have. It's called For My Dog. I thought I might travel to the Amalfi Coast this summer, but I prefer you, my little heating stove at my feet, to the warmth of 100 Italian suns. I would rather feel the rise and fall of your breath beneath my hand than all the bobbing boats of Positano. What good is seeing the Pietà when I can watch you watching me? The Trevi Fountain has nothing on our little spot down by our creek where you like to doze while I read.
That's another theme throughout the book, preferring home mm-hmm. to anything else, to any other
yeah.
place.
Yeah, I love to travel so much, but I also love home so much, and a big part of that is that the dogs can't travel with me most of the time, especially internationally. And so this is a true poem about when I had the chance to go to Italy for a couple of weeks. And I was just at a place where I needed to be with my dog, and I just couldn't go.
Sounds like the right choice to me.
I don't regret it a bit.
Italy will still be there.
Exactly.
Yeah. You have a murder mystery coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to tell us about it?
Well, it's interesting that the murder mystery, Dead Man Blues, and the poetry collection are coming out the same month because they're sort of opposites of each other. You know, the murder mystery is very commercial. It's totally genre. It's going by an old British mystery formula. And so, you know, it's more of a beach read. It's escapism. I think we need some escapism right now. And I often turn, all throughout my life, I've turned to mysteries for that escapism. And so I think in the poetry collection, I'm sort of holding a person's face and, you know, forcing them to look at the sorrow and the joy and all of that emotion. And in the murder mystery, I'm just thinking, here's something fun and interesting for you to escape for a little while. And you may not even think of another thing about this when you finish the book, but while you're in it, you'll love it.
So which one do you think will sell more copies?
Well, unfortunately, the murder mystery is going to sell more copies because people don't read as much poetry as they should, or at least they don't buy poetry like they should. You know, something that has given me a lot of hope, though, is that I feel like people talk more about poetry now than they used to. And I think the reason for that is social media. So many people share poems. And I think lots of people in the world think, oh, I'm too busy to read a novel, or I'm too busy to read a whole book of nonfiction. But I do have time to read this poem. And some of those poems are as profound, and they hold as much emotion and as much resonance as a whole novel, you know? And so I see poems online all the time being shared by people, and I love that. I hear references to poets, and just the other night I was watching a TV show and somebody mentioned Mary Oliver, you know, and just things like that. So in a way, I think that we are more in touch with poetry than we've been in a long, long time. I just want people to buy more poetry books.
You heard it on Accents. Buy more poetry books. And speaking about buying poetry books, you have a book launch coming up.
Yes. The book will be launched at Joseph Beth Booksellers in Lexington on September 9th at 7 p.m. That is pub day for this book. And so I will just be reading some of these poems, talking about the origins of them. A big chunk of that will just be Q&A with the audience.
And what are you writing these days?
I already have another novel finished. It'll be out in fall of 26. It's called The Tulip Poplars. It's a love story set over the course of the 20th century. Two love stories, actually. One is between two men who are from Eastern Kentucky, and one is between a white woman and a black man living in Eastern Kentucky. So it's a book about forbidden love and the obstacles that people have in just trying to, you know, be allowed to love each other. And, you know, unfortunately, that is still relevant today. It's a book I always wanted to write. It's the most sort of epic sort of story I've ever told, you know, spanning a long time and with these big themes. So I'm really excited about it.
Well, I'm excited about it too, and I'm excited about the murder mystery too. Well, I have one last question for you, and that is a question that I ask all my guests who teach creative writing, and that is, what is the most important thing you teach your students? If there is one thing you want them to remember from your class or workshop, what is it?
That you cannot be a great writer if you are not a great observer. And I spend a lot of time teaching my students how to just be still and to look at things closely. This is something that the modern world, we're competing against everything mainly, and I hate to be Archie Bunker here, but mainly the phone in our pocket and how it demands so much of our attention and the way the phone is set up to get that attention all the time. I teach a writing class occasionally in Ireland, and it's 3 weeks long, and I don't allow my students to have their phones out at all. They can't even take notes in their phone or take pictures of things when they're observing. Because if they don't, that forces them to write it down and put it into words in a different way. So the act of observation is really, really incredibly important. I think so many people also don't experience life enough to write about it mm-hmm. in a vivid way. I think that sometimes we get so caught up in the writing that we forget to live. You've got to live and have real experiences to write about it properly.
I appreciate you so much, Silas.
I appreciate you. Thanks for everything you do. And you're such an important part of our writing community in Kentucky. And I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you.
Thank you.